Hi, my name is Martin Purnell, and welcome to Off Grid Christianity, a weekly podcast for those who go or don't go to church, and for those that are disillusioned. This podcast series is to encourage via conversation and not necessarily change your mind prior to listening. You can contact us as well by email, ogc@accessradio.biz. Check out our Facebook page, Off Grid Christianity, and we have our own website, offgridchristianity.co.uk. So please enjoy today's guest, who was a BBC producer based in Cardiff, first for the religion department, but also then in news, current affairs, education, factor documentaries and music. Previously, he had led a Christian rock band all over Europe. He then studied theology, which must have helped, as later on he taught at Regent College in Vancouver, which is a grad school of theology. In 2013, he became the first incumbent of the newly formed Eugene and Jan Peterson Chair in Theology and the Arts. So, what does a TV producer actually do? What is the role of a chair in theology and the arts? What was the name of the rock band he was in? What was it like to be working with Dr. Desmond Tutu? What is liberation theology? How important are the arts? So with all these questions, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Ewan Russell Jones. Ewan, thank you so much for joining us today. Shall I say diolch yn fawr ichi?
Yeah, mae'n pleser I fod yma. Diolch yn fawr iawn.
Ah, thank you. I will just Google that bit, see what that means.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, thank you. As you can tell, ladies and gentlemen, he is of the Welsh origin. I'm of the English origin, but we can still be friends. Not a problem until we talk about rugby. So we might avoid that.
Yeah, might get a bit unpleasant at that point.
Whereabouts are we talking to you in Wales, good sir?
I'm in Cardiff, capital of Wales. Lived here since I was 15. Dad was a minister. We moved around South Wales a bit. So we moved here from Llanelli, 1970. And I finished off last 3 years of school here, basically, and then went to college.
Well, no doubt we'll talk more about that later on. But before we do, good sir, five maybe not so important questions so we can see what really makes you tick. Question number one, fingers on the buzzers, no conferring. If you could invite anybody from history for an evening meal, alive or dead, so that you could ask some questions, Ewan, who would it be?
This is such a tricky question, actually, for me. I mean, I spent my life in the BBC actually interviewing people and started in radio and doing what you're doing now, actually. had a regular weekly program where you could kind of, because it was the BBC, you could ring up pretty much anybody and they would say yes. And so I got to meet an extraordinary range of people, and that was great. There were people I didn't meet, I'd love to. Politicians, theologians, artists. I mean, I've got a massive shopping list. I'd probably prefer a dinner party, actually, a house party, a weekend house party. If really pushed, I spent 4 years full-time and 7 years of my life working on a doctorate on a group of people in the 17th century called the Levellers. And they were a group of radical political figures during the English Civil War pushed for a democratic settlement in Britain, the first democratic constitution in the world, actually, it would have been. And the kind of political ideas that they had didn't really surface for another century and a half, really, until the American Revolution, the French Revolution. And that was led by three people, a guy called John Lilburn, William Walwyn, and Richard Overton. And any one of those I'd love to have for dinner. I spent all this time reading this stuff and finding out about them. But I'd really love to find out more about what made them tick. William Walwyn, particularly, was a really interesting character because they were all Christians, these people.
Oh, really?
They had deep theological convictions, which comes through in their political writings. I wanted to find out where these ideas came from. I mean, how does this emerge? Because democracy is not although it's got this kind of Greek word that seems to go back to ancient Athens. Well, ancient Athens was far from a democracy in anything like the way we understand it. It was basically rich people and slaves, a few rich people, rich men and slaves. But here in the 17th century, in the midst of a crisis of crown against parliament, but also a crisis right across Europe of wars of religion, people fighting about religion, the question about what makes a citizen, what allows you to have a voice in society.
Yes.
And basically the Levellers said, well, look, it isn't the soundness of your doctrine. It isn't the soundness of your kind of your friendships or your class solidarity. It actually comes down to the dignity of the person and the fact that we've got rights, each one of us, and we've got obligations to others. So based on this Christian vision of the person, they came up with a democratic kind of idea for Britain. Was never, I mean, it was knocked on the head by Cromwell and his crowd, even though they were on Cromwell's side. But Cromwell quashed this because he really couldn't get his head around that. Cromwell sort of believed, really, like a lot of Christians do, that God had given him the sword, he said, and therefore he's going to use it. You know, he's going to bring the Reformation back to the rest of Europe and impose it on the Irish and all of this kind of, you know, so use the power to kind of impose a political settlement. Well, the levelers, that wasn't their way at all. And I don't think it's, you know, it was certainly not the way forward. At that time, Cromwell's revolution came to a dead end in 1660 and the king came back, and, you know, a new king. So it went nowhere. I'd love to hear from these levelers what their kind of Christian vision was of the person and of their vision for society.
Well, you're not going to believe this, but of all the podcasts that I have done, and I've done hundreds, if you take my radio career as well, that's probably the number one answer I always get, the levelers.
Is that right?
Yeah. No, not at all.
Well, most people have never heard of them, you know, and I totally get that. But I mean, it's a shame because they came up with basically what was the first democratic kind of constitution. Mm. It was never implemented. It gave rights to all sorts of people that were, you know, beyond the pale in those days. Roman Catholics, Jews, women, poor people. All of these would have been included in, you know, in a much wider franchise. It wasn't exactly a universal franchise, but it was way, way wider than anybody'd envisaged at the time.
You've just given me an idea for a future special podcast, Christians in Politics, you know, from all those years back.
Oh, yeah.
We could do one together. There is a thought.
There's plenty of material, good and bad. Yeah. Most of it bad. No. The Christian contribution to the political life, particularly of the West, is massive. I mean, it's a good story and a bad story at the same time, but there's really, really positive things to say as well.
Well, you're very passionate about that. It's great. I don't think I can arrange a meeting for you with them because my teletransport machine isn't working at the moment. But there is the folk rock band, The Levellers. They're still going. Would that
help? Yeah. There's plenty of ways in which The Levellers are still kind of respected. There's a great story about Burford in Oxfordshire, actually, where there was a kind of a leveller mutiny in the army. After the execution of King Charles I in 1649, the question, well, what comes next? The Levellers were pushing this democratic constitution and it got popular among the new model army. And some of the Leveller leaders in the army said, we're not prepared to do your bidding now, Cromwell, unless we know which direction we're going in. Cromwell wanted to send them off to Ireland to suppress the Catholics and, you know, do the many of the things that, we bitterly regret now. But Cromwell crushed that movement in Burford Churchyard. He came, surrounded the town at night with his own troops, found these guys in the pubs and everything like that. You know, they'd had a pint or two probably. Yeah. And he locked them up in the church, in Burford Church. The next day, he kind of lined them up on the church roof and he got the guys who were the ringleaders in the army to kind of be in the churchyard. And he basically gave them the chance to recant from the error of their ways. And some of them did, four of them didn't, and they were shot in Burford Churchyard in view of all of these other soldiers up on the church roof. I mean, it's an amazing story.
Wow. The number of times I've gone past Burford, never knew that.
Yeah.
Wow. Thank you. You should have been a history teacher. I would have signed up for your your courses straight away. Brilliant.
Yeah, I'm a rubbish historian as well as, you know, I have very limited passions.
Well, that's a great passion, history. It really is. And of course, you named the New Model Army, which is also another rock band from the my era. See many other bands you could name. Great answer. We've almost finished the podcast now. Question number two. Who is your favourite biblical character or favourite biblical story or favourite parable, please, Ewan?
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, I mean, the Sunday school answer is Jesus, isn't it?
Or a squirrel.
He is my favourite character of all time, an intriguing character. But one of my favourite passages in the Bible is in Mark 4. You've got these parables that Jesus teaches, these stories about what is the kingdom of God like, he asks. And then he answers it in this really curious way. You're thinking, what? You're scratching your head at the end. What does that mean? But one of them, there are a few stories all about seeds in that chapter. You know, the very famous one about the parable of the sower going out to sow. But it's not that one that is my top favorite. There are two others later on in the chapter. One is the parable of the kind of the growing seed that just the farmer sows it, and then it just almost magically, without him doing very much, it grows.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's left realizing that he didn't do this. It grows. But then the next parable is the parable of the mustard seed, this tiny little seed, which, you know, you sneeze and you blow it away and it's nothing really. But you chuck it into the ground. You think this is a tiny, insignificant thing. But then slowly, almost without anybody really noticing, it grows and grows and grows, and it becomes this kind of habitat, and all kinds of creatures can live in it, birds and you know, it becomes this kind of environment, but it's a kind of secret process. And I just loved that idea of God's kingdom, not as this kind of great triumphal thing that we got to go to war over and battle over, but, you know, something where God is truly at work, you know, through our insignificant lives, our insignificant actions. The kingdom grows, you know, but it's a secret kingdom, and it's a secret revolution that can take place in the world.
That's a great answer. Thank you. You actually mentioned my favorite parable of all time with the parable of the sower earlier on. But yeah, it was great to hear yours. And I was painting pictures in my head when you're talking. Thank you. Question 3. This could be interesting. If you were prime minister for the day and could change any law or impose a new law, Ewan, what would you do?
Oh, all these questions. I got so many, so many things I'd like to answer. I'm terribly opinionated about all sorts of things. You know, just racking my brains on this one. I feel like what I'd really loved. I went to a comprehensive school. I mean, I started off in a what was a grammar school in Llanelli, and then when I moved to Cardiff, that school was just changing over to become a comprehensive, and it was one of the first, you know, one of the first comprehensive schools in the 1970s. And I appreciated that. I loved it. But I know as I see education now, what problem. I mean, like so many public services, I think over the years, we've just denigrated public life. We've denigrated public services. I mean, so many things I'd love to do in health and so on. But education, I mean, I feel like the chance for kids, for every kid to have a really good education. I heard some staggering figures a while back about the number of kids who leave primary school and secondary school and they're functionally illiterate.
Yes.
That is never right. You know, we're one of the richest countries in the world. I just think that every child deserves to have good teaching, good schools, and good grounding in the basics of education. And on top of that, then, if I was asked which area would I really invest in, I would invest in the arts in schools. Again, things like music and theatre and painting and drama. These are things that we don't put a value on in terms of what is your qualification or whatever, but they're such a rich part of life. They're ways in which our humanity grows as we see and appreciate the work of others. So I'd really love to pour a whole shed load of money into education.
Well, make sure you can do that, please. That's a good answer. Christian,
if I ruled the world, every day would be the first day of spring.
That's a song somewhere. I'm sure it's a song. I won't be singing it. Question 5. What has been your most embarrassing moment to date, please, Ewan?
I mean, there are things that are embarrassing. I suppose embarrassment tends to be a public thing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, there are things I'm ashamed of that not too many people know about. I'm deeply embarrassed about those looking. I mean, professionally, I can think of one incident where I did something I thought I was doing it for the right reasons. I was actually, in some ways, I was doing it for, but it was a thing I did, you know, to a colleague in another way. And that embarrasses me. I know not many people know about that, and I couldn't talk about it openly for obvious reasons. But
yeah, my lawyers would have to talk to your lawyers, and
yeah. But I, you know, one thoroughly embarrassing moment, as you know, I went to theological college straight from school. I came out of there with a theology degree, London School of Theology, or London Bible College as it was then.
Yes.
Where I met a whole load of great people. But came out of there, you know, you think, oh, I'm a theology grad now. You know, you kind of, you know, you're qualified to pontificate about anything. But I was asked to give a talk on a Christian holiday. It was one of these mass Christian kind of events that you go on coaches. I know 4 or 5 coaches left London, and we were going to different destinations. But we first of all landed in Belgium, and that first night there were a few hundred people, and it was like a Sunday, so they planned a service, and I was asked to speak at this service. But you know, and I could see it was getting later and later in the evening, and it was going to be outdoors, you know, and it's just going to be a real problem because the wind was getting up. And it was getting later and later. It was just really badly planned. And eventually it got they did a whole bunch of singing, and then they got to me. By then, it's pretty much pitch dark. And I couldn't speak without notes. But not only was it, you know, really dark, the wind got up and just took, you know, so I was in kind of full flow at one point. Not doing very well, actually. I could see that most of the audience were thoroughly bored already. Congregation, as it were, the wind took my notes and blew them up into the air, scattered among the crowd, right? And in front of me on the ground. So I'm scrabbling around on my hands and knees trying to pick up my notes because I can't speak without my notes. As I got back to the place where I was supposed to speak from, this woman in the front, it was actually on a, you know, young woman, and I, you know, she had her problems, let's say, but she just said, "It's all right, love. Give us the notes and we'll read them in the morning." So I, you know, I thought, oh boy, you know, yeah, so much for your theological education here, but you can't hold this crowd.
That's brilliant answer, brilliant answer. I don't know if you noticed, I said question 5. I missed that question 4. So let's do question 4 now, if that's okay. Outside of family events, Ewan, what has been your most enjoyable day out, good sir?
I got interested in cave art, just as one of these, you know, it's a curious thing to be interested in. If we're interested in art at all, you're kind of interested in, you know, where does it come from?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
how is it connected to the human person, and how important is it in life? Well, one of the things that we know about human beings is that pretty much the first things that they leave as memorials for archaeologists to discover are not writing or books or whatever, but scribblings, drawings, etchings on the wall, simple carvings. And I've got really interested in this because it's just such an important part of the human story. It goes back thousands and thousands of years. I mean, when I first began to delve into it, there was a film came out in 2011 by Werner Herzog called Cave of Forgotten Dreams. And it's all about this cave that was discovered in France in the 1990s, called Chauvet Cave, after the potholder who discovered it. And those paintings in that cave go back 30,000 years, 32,000 years, and just amazingly beautiful things. You know,
yeah.
one of them was my kind of screensaver at the BBC, you know, from Chauvet Cave. But the film was great. But, I got interested in this stuff. And there's one painting from another cave in France, a place called Pêche Merle. It's known as the Panel of the Spotted Horses. 2 horses facing in different directions. It's like they've kind of got dappled coats. They're not dappled coats at all. They're spots that have been put on this painting deliberately. But they're not just within the body of the horses. They go outside the body of the horses as well. So there's something deeply kind of spiritual, even perhaps religious, going on there. And I was just so interested. I'd love to see that for myself. Many of these caves, you can't go in anymore because human presence in caves destroys the kind of chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, look, Lascaux Cave, which is one of the first caves to be discovered in France in the 1940s, that was open for many years until the 60s. And then they had to close it because there was fungus and stuff growing on. You know, people go in there, and they're breathing, they're farting, they're, you know, wearing perfumes and all, you know, and all sorts of things, which changes the chemistry of the cave. So most of these places you can't go. But Pêche Merle Cave, which is in the Lot region in central France, you can still go. And this is where the panel of the spotted horses is. So 2018, the beginning of 2018, I was able to go there with my wife and to walk, you know, to descend down into these caves and to stand in front of something that was painted by human beings, just like us, 25,000 years ago. That's just staggering, really. I loved it.
That's a brilliant answer. Thank you very much indeed. And yes, I can envisage what it must be like for you going into a cave that you know all about to see the picture up there. Very much like me going to Ashton Gate to watch Bristol City.
Yeah, well, it's not quite that level of excitement, but it was pretty exciting, I must say. You know, it just makes you think about the human story and how rich it is and how far back it goes as well.
Brilliant answer. Thank you. Well, you did say earlier on about a radio show that you used to produce and beyond. What was it called, by the way?
It was called All Things Considered. It's still going, actually, and on BBC Radio Wales. So I joined BBC in 1984. You know, it was in the religion department. It was, this programme came out of the religion department, but it was very much about the things that make people tick. So trying, you know, to see religious questions as kind of underpinning and spiritual questions and ethical questions underpinning so much of what we do in life. So actually the canvas, if you think in painter's terms, was just huge, you know, because it touches on everything, doesn't it? Faith. So, you know, I was able to talk to politicians and artists and theologians and just people involved in public life. And maybe when people have written a book or they'd been involved in some public debate or other that was deeply controversial. And you can see, they're coming from an interesting place here where there's a debate, there's a range of religious opinions as well as kind of non-religious opinions as well. So all of that. So talk to atheists as well as Muslims and all sorts of people who I'd never really given the time of day to before. I'd kind of been brought up in a Christian context, not a kind of dismissive of other people, but certainly not encouraging you to go out and talk to those kind of seek them out. You know, suddenly I was chucked into this and found myself deeply challenged almost every week, every time I had to prepare for one of these interviews programs, with ideas that were new to me and sometimes kind of challenging to my faith.
When you hear people go to theology college, I cringe at times because I'm thinking, oh, this could mean one of three things. One, that you come out as an atheist. Two, that actually you really do get it as a Christian. Or three, it's like you were never a Christian in the first place. You just went there so you could get a degree because it sounds good.
Yeah.
How did it help you or hinder you in your faith going to theology college?
Yeah, at that stage of my life, 18 years old, Dad was a Baptist minister. My parents were great people. And I thought the gospel had grabbed me as a teenager, no question. I kind of, you know, for the kingdom of God. And at that stage, my imagination, my frame of reference was pretty small. I thought it's the ministry. But the more I studied theology and the more I knew my own relationship with the church was a difficult one because I'd seen the way that churches operate and how brutal it can be, actually, and how difficult the life of ministers can be. And, you know, so I there was a certain kind of amount of anger in my heart as well, and resentment, I think, towards churches. I went on from the first theological degree to do Baptist college. You know, I went to a Baptist college in Cardiff to train specifically for the ministry, but I wasn't convinced at all, really wasn't. And during that year, I came to the conclusion, this is not my calling. I didn't feel I could do it. I didn't feel I could, it didn't feel like me. And so I thought, well, what else, you know, and that led me on I'll do some research, I'll delve in, because while, you know, I did have that kind of those thoughts about the church, which were ambiguous, let's say, I also was convinced that the Christian faith and Jesus Christ was true and, you know, deeply, deeply what is needful in life me and for the world as well. And I never lost my faith in that process, but I wanted to find a way of kind of, you know, could I teach theology? Could I go to other countries and, you know, and help them grow in their faith, whatever it was. So that set me off on this kind of journey of theological education. I did a master's up in Aberdeen University and then a doctorate in Oxford. And, you know, at that stage, I was still thinking about the church and, you know, living a church life, if you like, either within a theological college or something. But during that time, I also became deeply convinced of kind of what you just said, the way in which theology is so separate from life, the way in which Christian faith is so separate from the things that make us tick as human beings. And, you know, I just hated the ivory tower. I hated the idea that this faith, which is rich and has got massively important ideas that have come out of the Bible and that have been developed over the centuries, but that's not just for some theological elite. That's not just for the ivory tower. That's for everybody, not just for churches either. This is for the life of the world. That my ambivalence about the church grew, and my ambivalence about theological education grew during that time. Then out of the blue, it was 1984, and my wife Amanda, I was still in Oxford, I'd done 4 years. It was time for me to get a proper job by then. But what really forced my hand was the fact that she was pregnant, and she'd been supporting us up until that point. She'd actually done, you know, the jobs that that put food on the table, really. And I needed a job. So I was applying for everything, all these theological college jobs, and I wasn't getting them. I'd come close, you know, they say, oh, yeah.
You're top three.
I hadn't finished my doctorate yet, or, you know, but I didn't sort of land any of them. And then out of the blue, my mother rang up and said she'd seen a job advertised in the Western Mail. I never saw it. I never saw this job advertised anywhere. She told me about it and said, it's a job in the religion department of the BBC in doing youth programs. And I thought, now I didn't have any background in broadcasting whatsoever.
Yeah.
I'd written bits and pieces, done some popular journalism, written for Buzz magazine, and we'd set up our own magazine as well after theological college called Ship of Fools. So I thought, okay, well, I got that. But I'd also been in this Christian rock band, been based in the Netherlands. That was between degrees, basically.
What was the name of the band?
Oasis.
Wow. You knew Liam Gallagher, Noel Gallagher.
We should have sued.
I think there was another band as well called Oasis that did actually have a record contract.
We made a record, actually. We got proofs. Yeah. In fact, Oasis was a project of Youth for Christ in Europe. And they'd had this group of young people, which had been in existence, I think, a year or something like that. But that it kind of, you know, had problems, and they were looking for leaders. And I was over in Holland in 1978 with my mate Steve Goddard. We'd been there before with various kind of, because Youth for Christ in Holland had this amazing coffee bar thing going on during the summer. It was the 70s. It was definitely a kind of youth revolution. Yeah. It was, you know, rock and roll was big. And they had these coffee bars that they would set up in tents, basically. They'd put up a marquee in town centers around Holland. And we traveled around playing in these. And then the second time Steve and I were there in 1978, I met some people, and they said, well, look, you know, would you be interested? And I was doing further research in theology. They said to me and my wife, look, I mean, we need somebody to lead this rock group, Oasis, next year. Would you be interested? So we thought, yeah, great. So it was a really great adventure. We left Aberdeen, and went over and lived in Holland. And we traveled around Europe for about 18 months with this band, and we recorded an album, Eastbourne, with the great Les Moyer and other people at Eastbourne. So we got the record that says Oasis on it, you know. I had all of this kind of youth stuff as well, and I thought, okay, all of these theological colleges, I'd kind of show up, and they'd keep you there for a couple of days, basically overnight, you know, and grill you all these theological questions, and but you know, the students and the board and the faculty and stuff, they'd keep you there, but then they'd want to own you, basically.
Yeah.
In the interview I went for this job at BBC Wales, I was in and out of the building, I kid you not, in half an hour. I arrived at reception in Llandaff in Cardiff. They showed me up to the place where I was to have the interview. There were five people there. They grilled me. And the woman who was the top dog, a woman called Tulare Bevan, she said, "You seem to be a bit of a schizophrenic to me, love." She said, you know, not an appropriate word for schizophrenic, way of using it, but you're a bit of a schizophrenic. On the one hand, you're doing all this kind of highfalutin academic research, and then you go off and you're in this Christian rock band. You know, that seems to me like a ridiculous thing. How do you put those together? You know, most interviews I'd ever been in, in fact, every interview up until that point, I just never knew what to say. I was hopeless in interviews. But at that moment, I thought, wow, this is not two different things as far as I'm concerned. This is the same faith. I want to explore in a, you know, an intellectual context, ideas, richness of the human experience. But then also, I want to talk about it out on the street, in the public places. They loved that. You know, I mean, I don't know what the level of faith or lack of it in among these people was. But I came out of that interview feeling I couldn't have done any better.
Yeah.
It was just like, whether God was, you know, at that stage telling me, you know, yeah, this is the way forward. But I had a kind of sense of peace about it. And then I didn't worry about it. I didn't hear anything for weeks from the BBC. And then heard that I'd got the job. So amazing, really.
It is. And I want to take you back a few minutes from when you said, you know, you're working through resentment. What resentment were you actually working through?
Well, I said that difficult churches can be difficult places. Mm. And my parents were saints, really. I mean, you know, they put up with me as a child. But I mean, yeah, they were not people who were in it for the money or anything. I mean, you know, I wouldn't be a Christian today if it wasn't for my parents, without a doubt. You know, I've certainly had times of great doubt and you know, even unbelief. But I was always convinced that there was an integrity about their lives and a kind of consistency between what they said, what Dad said in the pulpit on Sundays, and what he taught and how he lived and what he tried to live. I mean, he wasn't perfect by any means, but I mean, there was a beauty and an integrity about them that I kind of valued. But also I saw them being trashed by various people, and sometimes by at an institutional level.
Yeah.
In some of the churches. And as I grew older and I saw the experience of other ministers and, you know, the way that other churches behaved, I realized, yeah, churches can be really, really awful places to be. And, you know, so I suppose being a son of the manse, it kind of did build up a kind of resentment against church to a degree.
And yet you went to theology college. Your whole life, really, I suppose, has been about God, or maybe not literally as in as a minister, but with other jobs available to you to do it and to share your faith.
When I was in school, everybody was kind of expected to do Latin for O-level.
Yeah.
But you could either do Latin or Greek, and I swapped to Greek. I thought, I'd done 3 years of Latin. I wanted to do something different, so I went over to Greek. When I moved to Cardiff at the age of 15, they told me that classical Greek wasn't available in that school. So I had to go back to studying Latin. The RE teacher, and I was the only guy doing RE for O-level, as it was then, he said, well, look, you can do a New Testament Greek section. Instead of studying the New Testament in English, you can do it in Greek. And the set passages were from the Sermon on the Mount.
Wow.
So I had to translate at that stage, 16, the parables, the Beatitudes. And that's just stayed with me, just blessed are the meek, blessed are the peacemakers. These are incredible words that you realize they're not just words. They fit with the character of Christ. They fit with this kind of a whole life that is lived for others sacrificially. So I've been grabbed by that ever since. So that has been alongside my parents' faith, as it were. I did have my own, and that vision has never left. I mean, I've been, I've had my own problems and still do. And some of them are intellectual problems but I've never lost that.
I want to give you a job, right? I'm going to make you the Bishop of all of Wales right now. If only I had the power to do it.
Don't go there.
I want to, because you said a word, unbelief at times. We all get doubts. End of. And I know there are people listening at the moment who are maybe holding on by their fingertips to God. Mm. You've seen what God can do in your life. You have seen what goes on around the rest of the world. You've seen the power of music, the power of art, whatever, to bring people to faith or to hold on to their faith, right? For those that are really struggling about even going back to church or just want to leave church, you are the Bishop of Wales right here, right now. What can you do?
I think all you can do as Christian leaders is really to inspire people with a vision. And I think one of the problems with Christian leadership is that we haven't given a vision in our churches and to the world of what the Christian life actually is. This is not a life just for life in a club, as it were, for people who are like-minded. This is for the life of the world, this faith. I'd certainly want to appoint as many visionary people as I could, but also to recognize that actually a lot of this happens at ground level in ways that are already there, but we've never praised them. We've never acknowledged the life of lay people in churches. I mean, what is a testimony? Is a testimony just about how many souls you've won? Well, it might be that. Yes, great. Good for you. But it also could be about Mrs. Jones, who took my wife to church when her parents weren't churchgoers, and they just rounded up the kids in the neighborhood and took them all to church every Sunday. Or the doctor who's battling away every day in a GP surgery, and really dealing with all sorts of manner of illnesses that are actually illnesses of the mind and of politics as well, of the body politic, people who are struggling with poverty. And by their care and their concern, they show a different way to people what the world can be like. Those are testimonies as well. It doesn't have to be this kind of magnificent tale of kind of Christian triumph and souls that are won. I don't think we've actually foregrounded the life of lay people in our churches and shown this is your ministry.
Yes.
This is, they're in the surgery, in the counselor's ward, in local politics, in business, this is for the life of the world. It's not just for the club. It's not just for Sundays. So I'd really want to foreground all of that and kind of say theology is for life. Christian faith is for life.
Well, to encourage you on that, from what you're saying, it really identify with me, because I've said to you off air and I've said on previous podcasts, I used to be a training officer, and every so often you'd have to go on a train the trainer event. And one of them was to see from a psychometric point of view, what makes you tick? And you fill out 100 questions or whatever, then you can put it onto a pie graph and you work out, is that what is your main motivation? And the three main motivators in anybody's life is money, promotion, or encouragement. When I answered all the questions, I was so far out off the chart for encouragement. That's all I wanted. I was pat on the back from my boss. Well done, good and faithful servant. That's all I needed. And we don't see it in church, like you said. Mrs. Jones, fantastic. The doctor, the GP, fantastic. But no, we seem to have this idea of getting testimonies where someone is saved. And fair play, you might have been a mass murderer. And then you have a change of life and you release after parole and you go around and you save 2,000 people, and people will go in the hundreds of thousands to hear them. But yeah, the most important thing is surely, let's look at the grassroots. And yeah, you mentioned in one of your emails or whatever, I read it, I can't remember where I read it now, about liberation theology.
Mm.
So as we're on a theological debate here at the moment, what exactly is liberation theology, please?
Liberation theology is a movement that came out of Latin America originally. Well, actually, it was a bunch of Catholics who kind of coined the phrase liberation theology. They saw what was happening in South America, particularly the ravages that history has played in South America in terms of colonialism, foreign powers coming in and dominating. So that brought in a racial element as well, which still exists in a lot of parts of South America. And then these massive inequalities of wealth. So you have astounding wealth in certain places, concentrated in landowning and stuff like that. And then huge levels of poverty of the mass of the people. What does the church have to say to that? What does the gospel have to say to that? Liberation said, the gospel is fundamentally about freedom. It is about freeing us at every level. It's not just about the freedom of our souls. It's about freedom experienced now in the world in all sorts of different ways, economically, artistically, yes, culturally, not the kind of imposition of power, but the flourishing of people to grow in freedom, for freedom Christ has set us free. Now, that in just some kind of head trip, that means something. And then they went back into the Bible and then they started looking, okay, well, what does the Bible have to say about politics? What does the Bible have to say about justice? And of course, once you start looking at the Old Testament, particularly, you know, you can't, there's almost no page on which God isn't concerned about care for the widow, the fatherless, the orphan, the poor, the justice being done to the, you know, to the alien, the stranger in your midst, the foreigners, the slaves. So they latched on to these kind of stories in the Bible, particularly the story of the Exodus, where God sets the people of Israel free. When Moses is told at the burning bush to go to Pharaoh's house and say, "Let my people go," that's the moment also where God's name is revealed. Moses says, "Who shall I tell Pharaoh has sent me? Who's your name? Tell me your name." "I am who I am, Yahweh." So this name that God, you know, gives is utterly bound up with the liberation of slaves. The revelation of this central kind of thing in salvation history is the revelation of a God who frees people from their chains. And I think that theme is utterly picked up in the New Testament by Jesus, the whole theme of Jubilee that you get in the Gospels. But, you know, Jesus standing up in the synagogue in Nazareth and reading from Isaiah, "God has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, liberation to the captives." It hasn't gone away, that kind of concern for justice. Sometimes, you know, when Christians are talking about righteousness, we make that sound like it's just a kind of thing between me and God. And no, that's a justice word. That is also about a just life, a just living, living in a right relationship, not just with God, but with others in the world. So liberation theology kind of explored all of that. It was picked up by Protestant theologians as well, and particularly now by a whole bunch of evangelicals in South America who have this thing called holistic gospel, holistic ministry, so that we minister to the whole person, not just to our souls, not just to our kind of spiritual kick on a Sunday, ministry to the whole person, which clearly involves a cultural vision, a political vision.
It's as if you're claiming that word back, because if you said holistic vision or holistic ministry 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, people think, "Oh, you're so new age."
No,
it's about the whole person. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, it's so connected with the word holiness, isn't it? What is holiness? Holiness was never just this kind of rarefied thing about kind of me and Jesus. probably is a God who's full of mercy, full of compassion.
Yeah.
Holiness is a wholeness for God, a singularity for God. So holistic is a great word, and it's certainly not a New Age word. Holistic ministry, the Latin Americans have been talking about it for a long time before New Age.
Yeah, yeah. We were talking about people hanging on by their fingertips, and what you've shared certainly has encouraged me. You know, we need to look out, we need to be part of it and give holistic ministry. For those, though, that are really holding on by their fingertips and saying, yeah, but I can't do anything, I might as well give up on God now, what would you say to them?
Yeah, well, I don't know what they mean by that. You know, I can't do anything. I mean, I can understand people kind of giving up on God, if you like, but not for that reason. I can't do anything. We're all just individuals at the end of the day. We are, you know, but we all have agency as well. We do have some power in the sense that we're able to relate to other people in our immediate circles.
Yes.
You know, what is the quality of my life then? What is the quality of my existence? What can I do for others? I can do something. Even if I can be in a better relationship with the people in my immediate, you know, that is something that matters. It's not insignificant that. This is the way the world works, actually. It is through these kind of networks of humanity.
Yes.
And where we're kind of exhibiting a full humanity, a whole humanity, or approximating towards that, that's the way the world grows and flourishes. So I don't accept that we can't do anything. Now, there may be people who are kind of bedridden, and some of the most amazing people I've met have kind of been people who you think they've got the tiniest kind of, you know, influence on anybody else, but they pray, they're concerned. My dad in his last years, I mean, I was so proud of him. He was blind. You know, but he was so interested in his family, what, you know, what we were all doing, what was going on in the world. And I know he and my mum were just praying, you know, regularly for everybody in, you know, certainly in our family, but praying for the life of the world. And, you know, that is something as well. That's a beautiful thing. That is like, you know, that's an expression of concern and care and love that can't be overrated, I don't think. You know, certainly I think if prayer just becomes this thing between me and God and I don't care about anything else, well, and it turns me off from life. But I don't, as I understand it, that's not what contemplate. I mean, nuns and monks and things that I've met over the years, that you think they're in cloisters, you know, they're living a kind of a hidden life, but you know, they're praying, they care, and that matters, I think, for the life of the world.
Takes the first step, and the first step has to be taken by that person concerned then.
Yeah. Going back to that parable of the mustard seed, it's in these ways that the kingdom grows. You know, I think that's the beauty of what Jesus was talking about. What's the kingdom of God like? It's like a mustard seed. Well, do I have, you know, is there a mustard seed even in me? Well, maybe there is. And maybe, you know, I don't know what I, to use that seed metaphor, I don't know what seeds I plant by, you know, what I say, but, you know, by my actions. But you kind of believe, you've got to believe that God is at work. That's where the kingdom is. Who knows what might flourish as a result? It may not have nothing to do with me in the end. It grows regardless of me, but I planted it. I kind of, you know, I had some kind of role in it. And then suddenly, whoa, it's flourishing. And the birds are living in it, and all sorts of things are happening over there that I could never have imagined.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. My wife's relation, she was bedridden for the last 20 years of her life, but her Christian faith was phenomenal, you know, and she'd be writing letters or emails and just doing that sort of stuff as well.
Yeah.
Along with watching NCIS, and she thought she was going to marry Gibbs, but that's another story altogether. Your wife, Amanda, she came up with a cracking quote that I read on Interweb thing. And it said, following Jesus isn't simply about Sunday worship, but relates to our jobs, families, art, relationships, social and political responsibilities, environment, to the whole fabric of life. I thought, well, that's what she said. Let's ask her husband, what does he take from all that?
She's right. She who must be obeyed. No.
Yeah,
she's
next question. Ding.
She's bang on. we met in theological college. She did a doctorate a few years back, you know, kind of later in life, on an amazing woman, Christian woman from the 19th century called Josephine Butler. Josephine Butler campaigned over a very unpopular issue in the 19th century that was about sexually transmitted disease. And the British government had brought in these laws about the spread of syphilis, the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. And what they decided to do to protect the British Army, where this was rife, was to lock up any woman who was kind of suspected of prostitution. They didn't lock up the guys, they locked up the women. Josephine Butler felt that this was completely wrong, because not only was it kind of targeting the wrong people, as it were, but it was also just a way of furthering the sexual double standard in British society in the 19th century. And because of her Christian faith, because of her faith in Jesus, who she called the liberator back in the 19th century. So it's not even a kind of, you know, she and her husband, you know, she felt that she had to go to battle for these women and this to battle against this law that the British government had brought in, because that was a symbolic of the sexual double standard. Men could basically go out and sow their wild oats. Women stay at home. They shouldn't have nothing to do with anything. You know, shouldn't even hear about all of this kind of stuff. It's just a way of furthering the inequality of women and the oppression of women in the 19th century. Kids, you know, girls who are chucked out of the home when they become pregnant, quite often for no fault of their own. I mean, sometimes there were, you know, and then what are they, what kind of life? Now that was a Jesus vision that drove her, you know. So Amanda, you know, certainly gripped by that idea that Christian faith relates to absolutely every area of life. And, you know, our vision for the faith has got to be a whole vision for the whole world. It's not just for the club.
Well, that's a great answer. What can we do about right here, right now then, Ewan?
Keep doing your thing. Broadening your imagination. I mean, I think you're broadening our imaginations by talking to a lot of different people and, you know, with different ideas. We're so defensive as Christians a lot of the time. We feel like, oh, we're under threat. You know, I get really tired hearing Christians in Britain talking about the way we're oppressed and, you know, rubbish. You know, we don't know the half of it.
Yeah.
We don't know what real persecution is. And to pretend that we're in some kind of persecuted minority situation, it's such an insult to people who really are Christians in the world, who really are in peril just by confessing the name of Christ. We're not in that situation. Of course, we're in a situation where we see the decline of the churches. We see the decline of the kind of the name of Christ in, you know, in public places. Yeah, that can be difficult. But what is our answer to? Is our answer to kind of circle the wagons, just fight for our rights and our we're gonna maintain these standards and, you know, woe betide anybody else who kind of contravenes them. And we gotta insist that we kind of project this politically. We're going to go into battle. We're going to have a Christian party or a Christian movement that is going to bring back righteousness by imposing laws. You know, I just think this is such a mistake. But can we broaden our imaginations? Can we actually talk to people who are different to ourselves?
Yeah.
Can we actually be out in the world, actually living our lives as Christians? I know this can be difficult. I certainly didn't find it easy at the BBC over the years. But I think one of my biggest problems was my defensiveness, my assumption that people didn't want to hear about Jesus, that didn't want to hear about Christ. Actually, that's not what I found. That there was a lot of ignorance about Christ, a lot of ignorance about what the church has been and is, because there are a lot of assumptions now. We're the nasty party, you know, the Tory party. You know, there was a time when people said, oh, you know, the Tories are the nasty party. And I think quite often people look at the church now and they see us now as the nasty party. We're going to be against everybody. We're against gays. We're against opinions that are different to our own. You know, we're going to go into battle, culture wars, you know, all of You know, I don't think this is the way forward. I think the way forward is to be confident in our faith, but live our lives in the world humbly before Christ. The kingdom doesn't grow by Jesus being the kind of king that the president is or the emperor was. Whatever King Jesus is, he's very different to the kings of the world. He's the king of the mustard seed.
Yes.
King of the silent revolution.
So you are, don't forget now, the bishop. In fact, I've promoted you now to Archbishop of Wales. All right. And the next time I'll see you again, it'll be the Archbishop of Europe, because you're doing very well. You're ticking all my boxes. So if I came to you and said, well, look, I like going for a pint of beer. I go and play golf. I go and watch Bristol City. Am I okay, Gov? Would you just stamp this card? You'd be all right with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent answer.
Yeah. And what, you know, what are you talking about? The pub. You know, yeah, you're going to talk about Bristol City. I'd rather talk about Liverpool. I'm particularly concerned about, you know, who's going to replace Klopp. That worries me more than whether they'll win anything else this season. But what else do we talk about? The pub? Well, we're going to talk about all sorts, aren't we? And naturally, we're going to talk about Jesus at times. Not all the time. He's not the only thing we can talk about. I want to talk about, yes, the quality of the football that City are playing, or, you know, Liverpool. You know, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about rugby. I want to talk about the arts. I want to talk about poems that, you know, have touched me. And people are just amazing. People from all sorts of different walks of life who I don't see eye to eye on many things, but, you know, there are things about them I think, oh, wow, that's really lovely and impressive and beautiful. And that's a sign of God at work in the world. It may not be an overtly Christian sign at times. Often it's not, but thank God for it. You know, thank God for the goodness that's out there in the world. It comes from somewhere. It comes from the Father of all goodness.
Yes. In the closing of this, before we can find out who your Christian hero is, as a training officer, we used to say, the number one thing to remember is people buy people. That's why you buy, because you trust somebody. So if you're building up a relationship with somebody on the golf course at Ashton Gate, that football ground in Liverpool, I can't remember what it's called now, named after a girl, Anne something, I can't remember now. You're building a relationship. And there will be a time when one day someone will say, what's this about you going to church then? What's all that about? And the doors are open.
I mean, I had some great friends at the BBC who were very committed atheists. They still are. You know, I didn't make them into magic Christians, but they're great friends. I learned so much from these people, I got to say. They weren't the kind of the enemy in that sense. They're my friends.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love them to, you know, to kind of get a real experience of God that changes their, you know, that grips their imagination. But one thing I do know is that God is not off, you know, he's not like, you know, one of those things that, you know, at a dinner party, you can't talk about, you know, religion and politics. You know, these guys, when I have a pint with them, you know, quite often the first thing that they want to talk about is something that the church has been doing. The Pope has said, God is being accused of it at the moment. They want to talk about God. Quite often, I think the people who seem to be the furthest away from the kingdom are actually the closest, including some of the atheists of the world. And I really do believe that.
Yeah, well, listen, that's a great point to end on. And we mentioned earlier on as well, and you did in particular, I was going to say Josephine Baker, but no, it's Josephine Butler. Josephine Baker is something completely different in France. And what a great testimony she's got, great life story. But let's find out then. Ewan Russell Jones, who is your Christian hero, please?
You know, like with all of your questions, I've had difficulty kind of pinning anything down. I mean, you know, there are lots and lots of people that I've kind of learnt from and admired. I made a couple of films about Martin Luther King. I mean, King's got his problems. You know, he's definitely, whatever he had feet of clay, there's no question about it, you know. I admire him enormously, and I think he's a very much underestimated theological resource. I mean, his sermons, which are available, way more than just the "I Have a Dream" speech and "I've been to the mountaintop." You know, there's a lot more, and it's rich, and it's, you know, it's very biblical and very much centered on Jesus. You know, I think he understood the way in which the world changes is not through violence. It's through the way of Jesus, the way of the cross, taking up your cross and following him, not wanting to do violence to your enemy, but wanting to convert your enemy through love. Yeah. Love your enemies, said Jesus. Do good to those who hate you. So I love King because behind him is Jesus. I mentioned earlier, I wouldn't be a Christian if it wasn't for my parents, you know, and I would have to put them right up there in terms of, you know.
Fly the flag for your parents, because I love it when people choose people that we've never heard of. So in the remaining 2 minutes, tell us a bit about your parents then, please, and why they're Christian heroes.
Dad was from very working class background in Gorsynon near Swansea, outside of Swansea. His father was a tin plate worker. And in fact, his father, my grandfather, went to school with Evan Roberts, the Welsh revivalist. The Welsh revival of 1904.
I've been to the very church.
Lacha, which is where my father grew up. Lacha Common, where he was born. And, you know, Dat, my grandfather, shared a desk with him in school. Now, the Welsh revival of 1904, that did touch my grandparents to a degree, but it didn't have a major effect on them. I think it was later in his life that my grandfather really became a committed Christian. My grandmother was another saint, really. I mean, she was a, you know, very, very quiet, very humble, but she was the big influence in my father's life in kind of the example that she showed. He grew up during the Depression, and she just remembers all these kind of soldiers from the First World War coming, you know, penniless, needing something to eat. Well, they had virtually next to nothing, but she would always share, and you know, that was the way that they kind of lived. My grandfather started the trade unionist movement in his works in Gorsynon, and was a kind of leading figure in that trade union, but a Christian at the same time. And so, you know, all of these things formed my dad. Dad had a love for Jesus that certainly came from his mother, and then he wanted to preach it, and he was a very good preacher. He's quite a well-known preacher in Wales. He was a scholar as well. I mean, he was invited to go on to do a PhD after he did a BA and a BD, Bachelor of Arts, and then followed by a Bachelor of Divinity. But he wanted to get on with ministry. That's what he wanted to do with his life. And so he turned his back on that. His first degree was in Hebrew and philosophy. Mm-hmm. And then he studied Greek himself. So his books were on his shelves, you know. So when I was beginning to kind of show an interest in all of these things, he could point me to certain things that helped me. And so, you know, a love for books came from him as well. But from him and my mother, this kind of idea of service. Mum was from another valley in South Wales, the Garu Valley, Pontacoma. Her father was a mining. He was a kind of higher up in the hierarchy than my father's parents were, you know. So there was a bit more money in their family, but it was all relative. Mum went to university. She did a degree in German and music, and then was recruited in the Second World War. Dad was a pacifist, right? He, you know, love your enemies, do good, you know, Sermon on the Mount, all of that. Mum was recruited into MI5.
She
was a codebreaker at Bletchley Park.
Oh, was she?
Yeah. Amazing story, which we only really learnt about much, much later in her life. Ah. When she talked about it, she signed the Official Secrets Act. It was deadly secret, all of this, because all of the work they did continued to be important during the Cold War, after the Second World War, you know.
I went round Bletchley Park last year. What did she tell you, if anything, about it?
Yeah, my brother, Gethin, wrote a book about her and my father, actually, which are interesting. Gethin is a Baptist minister, and he did a book about Dad called Conscientious Objector.
Yeah.
He was a conscientious objector. Mum is called My Life in Hut 6. Hut 6 was absolutely at the centre of Bletchley Park. What they tried to do, because it was so top secret, they didn't want many people to know the big picture of whatever was happening in the codes they were breaking and stuff like that. You know, in other words, how much the British knew, about what the mm-hmm. the enemies were doing. So Hut 6 was where all the work from these isolated other huts around Bletchley Park was brought together. That's where Alan Turing was as well. You know, so my mother knew Alan Turing, you know, kind of major figure in the development of the computer, you know, major figure in the whole history of the war, really. I mean, if it hadn't been for these people, there wouldn't have been an Allied victory. Yeah, my mother was involved in trying to break codes on a daily basis. I mean, by the time she actually was allowed to talk about it, when she's in her 80s, she'd forgotten much of it and she'd suppressed much of it, of course. What we didn't know was, here was this woman with an incredible intellect from the Welsh Valley, goes off. A lot of the women at Bletchley Park were, you know, and colleagues were from Oxbridge. She was a university girl from Cardiff. And she was also a very devout believer, Christian. So she, you know, she was never, one to brag about her life and to talk about these things. We knew that she'd done war work. She'd worked for the Foreign Office. That was the kind of the code.
Yeah.
But then it started coming out in the 80s, basically, about how important this whole place was, Bletchley Park. And we started thinking, Mum was there, you know. First of all, she couldn't talk. You know, people asked her. She went, in fact, on a visit to Bletchley Park in the early days when it was opened up as a kind of museum. My brother took her, because he was working down the road and he in Milton Keynes. Yeah. And he said, Mum, there's this place, you'd be interested. So she goes there on an open day. And the guy who's leading them round asks people, you know, do you know anybody who was involved in doing intelligence work? And a German guy puts his hand up and says, I used to do this kind of work on the other side. And then the guy said, oh, really interesting, got him talking a bit. He said, anybody know anybody who worked here? And my mother put her hand up. She said, yeah, I do. And he said, well, who do you know? She said, well, I worked here. And it was like, whoa. I mean, that, you know. But then he said to her, well, can you tell us about what you did? She said, well, I couldn't talk about that. Because she signed the Official Secrets Act. See? You know, she took it so seriously even then. And people used to crack up under the pressure. A lot of people had nervous breakdowns working at Bletchley. She didn't, but she had quite ill health after that because of the pressure, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to fly the flag is one thing, but please give them a name check because I'm going to be ordering that book, My Life in Hut 6.
Yeah. Meyer Elined Russell-Jones was my mother's name, and Gethin Russell-Jones is my brother, who wrote the book about her, My Life in Hut 6. And then Conchi is the book that he wrote about my father. There are aspects of that book that I disagree with. Whereas I was very proud of my father's conscientious objection, my brother was rather embarrassed about it.
Yes, yes.
He's coming at it from that angle. I mean, I love my brother dearly and we respect each other. But, you know, I think some of his interpretation of my father's pacifism, I wouldn't necessarily agree with. But it's a really good book. Conchi, that's called, by Gethin Russell-Jones.
And your dad's name?
His name was Thomas John Russell Jones, TJ Russell Jones.
TJ Russell Jones, brilliant. Ewan, I could listen to you for hours. I know we've shot well over, so I'm going to have some fun editing it down just a
tag. Good luck with that. Yeah, I know what that's like too.
But thank you very much indeed. And just in closing, when you said you're in Holland, please tell me that when you were going past the windmills, you would say from time to time, I saw a mouse, and it all turned back and say, where? And you go, there under the stair. Did you ever do that joke?
There on the stair. What's on the stairs? Yes. No, I don't think I ever did. That was a bit too passé for me. I was rocking around in a rock and roll, man. This was the punk era. That was the kind of stuff that was heard on the home service of the BBC.
You're talking punk, you're talking my language even more. We'll have to talk about that off air. Ewan Russell-Jones, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a sheer privilege. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
God bless. Bye-bye.